Well, hello and welcome to the 13th episode of the Wright County Restoration Project podcast. My name is Jamin.
And I'm Sam.
And we are back again with President, almost President number two. We're gonna start with a little more George Washington, and then we'll work into President number two if all goes as planned.
Very good.
In this episode. However, we wanted to start by contemplating something which is fresh in the minds of people today. And that relates to George Washington, and not just George Washington, but as we think of Thomas Jefferson, and from what I understand, all but one of the first 12 presidents were slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
And this is becoming a problem in our culture today, a culture that is unglamorously called cancel culture,
yes.
Where it seems as though various men who are respected from years gone by, leaders such as George Washington, even Abraham Lincoln, are being removed from public consciousness on the basis of the fact that they were slave owners, racists, and that their ideas, therefore, are being invalidated, their legacies are being invalidated by people who feel as though they are not worthy of the time, attention, and honor that the country has chosen to give them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that we need to address.
Absolutely.
Because it is true that George Washington was a slaveholder.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that slavery was not outlawed or anything of
yes.
the sort as it related to the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States. There were debates about slavery,
yes.
to be sure. And we're not going to get into all the weeds of those debates today about slavery. That's not what we're here to do in this round. Here we're talking about the presidents. But it is time to think through George Washington
mm-hmm.
and his relationship to slavery, and perhaps give a more nuanced argument than a simple yay or nay, up or down, thumbs up, thumbs down, as it related to him and as it related to several of the, as it relates to anyone, really.
Right.
And the legacy that we leave behind. So what issues are we contemplating here today?
Well, I think it's interesting when you look at slavery in particular, and like you were talking about with cancel culture and things, this has really become the cardinal sin.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that stands out more than anything out of these men's lives. And this is what's drawn to the surface to really denigrate their place in history.
Mm-hmm.
And while slavery is something that is abhorrent
yep.
to our sense of justice and propriety, it's good to remember the times in which these men lived, and also the world in which this slavery was going on. America was only one of many, and actually kind of late to slavery,
mm-hmm.
as it were. Of course, in looking at the biblical record, slavery starts, or at least the accounts of slavery start very early on in the history of the world, and far more often, even looking through Greek and Roman times, slavery wasn't one group of people enslaving another group of people that looked different to them. It was often enslaving people that looked exactly like the people around you.
Right.
And we see through history, I mean, Rome, we see, you know, slave uprisings under Spartacus and other things, that slavery was a really big issue. It was a system
yes.
that many cultures have been built upon. And while all these things, it is good to remember those things, it's good to remember that in a way, slavery was even placed in America, in possibly not necessarily even in a willing sense, or it wasn't something that was intentionally planted in America. But it was started nonetheless,
mm-hmm.
and we see, especially because, as we talked about last time, the South in the nature of it, where you have more people of means, people of land, and you have these people, it and also an agrarian society,
right.
that it lended itself far more to slavery. While there was slavery in the North, in places like Massachusetts and these areas, it just wasn't profitable. and it begins to die out. And really, it wasn't terribly profitable in the South until the advent of the cotton gin and the cotton industry that really pushes it. It accelerates massively, which then continues on. But as we're talking about these men and their being slave owners, having slavery as a part of their life and their just the goings on of their plantations and how they did all these things, it's good to take each person and how they handled it separately and mm-hmm. also look at the times in which they lived and that it was not something that even they themselves intended to, well, I'm going to become a slave owner. It was something that was handed down to them several generations in line. And often, like even George Washington, was something that he got, most of his slaves came through marriage.
Right.
And so it's something that was a part of their the fabric of the civilization in which they lived. And it, in their eyes, and looking at the culture as it was, it would have been, in a sense, wrong and hard on those slaves if you just gave everyone their freedom. And that's a hard thing for us to understand. Yep. Because we think as free people.
Right.
And that has nothing to do with your race, but there is an idea, and we see this, whether it's through indentured servitude of many of the Irish and Scotch-Irish people that came over, and that happened much in the North,
yep.
or slavery of Africans that were brought over here. All of those things, the people that live their life always getting their orders for what to do in their life, it is a very interesting culture shift and a very difficult thing, and we see this happen to be on their own. Yep. and to think for themselves, to take care of themselves. And while that's not necessarily an excuse, it would definitely put it at an extreme disadvantage. Anyone who was just as a blatant statement given their freedom.
Yeah, so what you're asking us to do is to introduce a little nuance.
Yes.
Into this argument. And there's so many things you said there which are important. I should have written some of them down so that I could think through them one by one and address them as far as they need to go. But you mentioned the fact, as it related to Rome and Greece and all of these other cultures that had slaves, the idea of systems. Mm-hmm. And there are real recognitions of classes in society. And we are living in a society which, by and large, has sought to have a classless society, where we have a middle class and an upper class, but there's fluidity between those classes, where yes. a person can start in one generation dirt poor and in the lowest rung, and in his lifetime or in the lifetime of his children or grandchildren, they can be in the upper crust of society as far as the class system. And for we as a people to understand the idea, like we even still see in India today, where you're born into a caste,
yes.
and that is your caste, and you will never get out of that, no matter how talented you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how hard you work, this is your caste. And this is a world in which we find ourselves still in.
Yes.
And it's transitioning at this time. We think of what's happening in France with the revolution and the mm-hmm. ideas of inequality and what's happening with the Enlightenment. We think of what's happening in Great Britain and the conversations that are being had and the fights that are being had and that will be had later. So we think about these ideas, and of course you had various groups, religious groups who were very anti-slavery. If you think
Absolutely.
About, I believe the Quakers were quite anti-slavery,
very much so.
And we also had Roger Williams and the Baptists who were very much against these sorts of things. But there was still a tremendous cultural battle going on, and the counterculture of the day was anti-slavery. That was not the dominant culture
very
of the day.
So.
The dominant culture of the day was slavery, and then as you mentioned, the differences between indentured servitude and this chattel slavery, mm-hmm. like we think of, where a person is actually degraded to a subhuman level,
yes.
as opposed to the idea that a person is working in a class. The other thing that you mentioned, and this connects somewhat to George Washington and to much of the South as you related it to the aristocracy, and the idea that we find in Great Britain, particularly throughout the time of the feudal lords, and then as we get into later times, that there was a very clear class system in place, mm-hmm. and the aristocracy, what we would call today the modern elites, the elites were intended to be that level of society that was educated, and that not only had thus the privileges of the elites in society, but had the responsibilities through those privileges of bearing the burdens of society, the responsibility of leadership, the responsibility of supporting others, so that if a man had if he was an earl and he had an entire estate under his watch care, he had responsibilities to those who were his tenants, to those who were his villeins, to those who were on his property. His success was their success, and yes, they could never really move up into mm-hmm. those elements of society, but they did have a purpose, and this man's livelihood and his good decision making and his leadership affected all of them. So that these men would, in the right time, of course, aristocracies right. and elites, they tend to devolve over time into irresponsible, selfish, self-entitled people. But in the right time and in the right way and with the right mindset, these men saw all of their education, their military service, which was a big part of this mm-hmm. as well. They saw all of these elements of their lives as the means by which to serve the society with the money and the power and the influence and all of these things that they had. And so we have a mindset here where when you have men and women under you and you are caring for them, as you mentioned, the idea of cutting them loose and just letting them go may not even just be, it most certainly was not simply a discussion about is this moral or immoral to own them. It's also a discussion about what happens when I let them go.
Right.
And I think we see this, and we'll get ahead of ourselves here for just a moment, in Reconstruction.
Yeah.
And we see this not even just in Reconstruction, but even in the 60s with the Civil Rights Act and all of the desegregation and all of these different times in American history where if you don't have a plan to take people who have been, I'm going to use a hot button word today, systemically disadvantaged.
Yeah.
And it's true.
It is.
Slavery
Absolutely.
Is systemic disadvantage, and there was definitive systemic disadvantage for the former slaves after the failure that was Reconstruction and then Jim Crow laws and the South and everything that happened there. And so if we look at all of that without a plan, you are setting people up to fail.
Yeah.
And I believe this is in large part what we have seen, unfortunately, mm-hmm. and a part of that can be perhaps attributed to President Lincoln getting assassinated after the Civil War and some of these various things and Reconstruction just going so horribly. But I would believe that this is very much so some of those things that George Washington, among others, feared, which is that we cannot just release uneducated, completely different cultured people into society without damage both to them and to the society that is around yes. them. And again, this is not to in any way justify slavery. Mm-hmm. This is important.
Yes.
In Acts chapter 17, verse 26, within this message that Paul gives on Mars Hill, he says, and we've talked about this before, verse 25, speaking of God, he is not worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth.
Absolutely.
One blood. And that means that there is one race, and that is the human race. And so we recognize the immorality of degrading the image of God in man by degrading certain men based upon either immutable characteristics, such as the color of one's skin, mm-hmm. or even holding men under a erected system of oppression,
right,
in order to keep a person in line or in his class. But there is significantly more going on here than just that. How do you change the culture of an entire society? Mm-hmm. How do you usher people who have nothing into a society, who are illiterate into a society? What do you do with them in the meantime? How do you make sure that they don't just end up in segregated ghettos, yeah, maintaining this poor, disadvantaged state? And all of that takes care.
Mm-hmm.
And planning. And I think what we see throughout American history is, of course, as we're working through this, we do see the results of what, yeah, happens when that care and that planning and these things are not brought into place. We see it with the former slaves. We also see it with the former Native Americans and what happens when you do give reparations. And you do try to give them their own space, and it has been somewhat disastrous,
yeah,
for the Native Americans in our country. And so this is that nuance, mm-hmm, you know, that we consider, considering the type of people that we're dealing with, the culture that they're dealing with, and not excusing the wrongs, but simultaneously not standing in judgment over them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have no place to do that. We have no standing to do that. We can stand in judgment over ourselves, and we will do so as we walk through this life, but to stand in judgment over people in an entirely different culture, at an entirely different time, under the nuances of their arguments, we can stand in judgment over the act.
Right.
But not necessarily over the people. And I hope that we can paint that nuance. The difference between the act, which is evil, and the people in the culture, the time, the circumstances within which they found themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think as we see in the founding documents and how things even went with the Constitutional Convention, there were men in those groups that, while they were slaveholders themselves, did, and one could say they didn't do enough.
Yep.
But they did try to put things in place. They were envisioning the sunsetting of slavery. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, you know, of course, they couldn't see into history and how things would accelerate and make slavery such a big part of things. At the time of the revolutions, things were, and after that, things were, it was becoming archaic. It was becoming, yep, less of a cultural norm, and they put things in place. And it is fascinating to think that, you know, even though, of course, we, you know, would say, well, you know, what did they mean by this? But we look at things like the Declaration of Independence,
yep,
and it says all men are created equal, and things like that. And one could say, well, what kind of men were they talking about there? But nonetheless, it's in that document, and that there are things that we can look back on and say, you know, we can take those documents and say, yes, you know, at their time, maybe they had some prejudices.
Yep.
Maybe they had some things that weren't correct. But moving forward, we can see that the way those documents were put together, and since there have been some amendments and things that have helped flush some of those things out, but it is far from our place, like you said, to hold those men in contempt because of something that was in their time and in their place, and also and to throw out everything,
right,
that they stood for, that they did, that they were able to accomplish, is very unwise just because they were a part of a system that really they were born into just as much in a way as the slaves that were under,
yep,
them.
Very good. And it is also important, you mentioned, we talk about slavery as a black-white issue, but it never has been.
No.
Nor has bigotry.
You know,
as we think about this country, there are tremendous bigotry against the Irish,
mm-hmm,
against the Italians. We have seen bigotry, religious bigotry against,
yeah,
against Catholics, against Jews, at various times among various people groups for various reasons. And even slavery itself has never been about one race or culture, race in the loosest usage of the term, one colored skin versus another, typically speaking, that has been a line that has drawn because there have been different cultures that have segregated among such differences, and yet it has never been that way. It has always been both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And characteristically also enslavement of one's own people.
Yes.
For other reasons, such as the same people but different religions, or right. the same people but different tribes, or the same people but different fill in the blank.
Yes.
And so, again, calling everybody that's listening unto a nuanced argument where you need to be honest, as we all should, with the realities on the ground of what these men did and who they were. And we don't need to lie, nor should we feel the necessity of overlooking the choices that they've made, but in a broader, wiser, more careful way, we consider various elements of time period, of culture, and of the tremendous fragility
mm-hmm.
of the Union at this time, a fragility that never would have withstood an abolitionist movement. There's no way that
right.
that the Union would have withstood a hard line on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a priorities issue in place here as well.
Very true. Very true.
Any other thoughts on George Washington in particular? As you said, most of his slaves were from his wife and inherited from her family. And on his deathbed, George Washington did free his slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And left his wife's slaves in her care until her death.
Yeah.
We do see a recognition with George Washington particularly of his desire to see them freed and the tension that was in his own heart and mind on this issue.
Very much so. Very much.
Okay. John Adams.
Very good. John Adams. So, number two, our second president, who was the vice president mm-hmm. under Washington.
For all 8 years.
And so we turn to a hard act to follow.
Mm.
A hard thing to do. Washington was a very great man and much beloved by the American people. And John Adams steps into this role at a very difficult time.
Mm.
John Adams is a part of the Federalist Party. We talked a little bit about that last time, but there's kind of two parties that form, and the Federalists are really pushing for the federal government in
which
a way.
Which means a strong centralized
yes.
government as opposed to the power being more vested in the states or mm-hmm. a loose organization of states.
Yes, very well put. And in a way, what they were pushing for under that time as a strong central government is nothing close to what we have today in a strong federal government.
Right.
But it was definitely more of a strong federal government than the Democrat side, as they were more pushing for the power to be vested in the states and in that way. So we have John Adams come in. John Adams is a very interesting man, very instrumental before he becomes president mm-hmm. in he and Thomas Jefferson are really the authors and the ones that come up with the Declaration of Independence. John Adams he's from Massachusetts. He's a man of books and of learning, of knowledge, of the law. He is not he does not own vast plantations. He's more of a farmer mm-hmm. in a way, but he is not in the same stature, as it were, in what class systems there were of Washington. But he is he is just as much a public servant. He's just as much a man that steps into the times that he lived in. And his mark, while we don't think about him as much as we would think about others, is large on the revolution, and in the goings on after that. He's not really involved that much in the Constitution because he's a ambassador to England at the time, and so he is over there at that time, and so that's one of the reasons he's not really involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
As is Thomas Jefferson, he's emissary to France. But when John Adams takes the presidency, there are global issues, global things at play that really begin to shift things rather quickly away from the happy days that we had after the revolution, that all was happy and everything was fixed and we had our own country. And then but globally things are really kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. We have the French Revolution going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, France is at war with England, Austria, and Prussia at this time. And we have really a world in turmoil.
Mm.
And being that these 13 colonies, the United States, are on one side of the Atlantic Ocean, shipping and ships really become an important part of the infrastructure and the means to get and to moving goods and wealth back and forth. And both England and France began impressing sailors into their navies. Impressing was a system by which if they just needed men to serve, they would go to seaport towns, and really just anybody they could get their hands on, they would empty out the taverns and the grog shops and whatever they could. And if they got a hold of you, you were against your will, speaking of slavery, signing up to be a part of Her Majesty's Navy, His Majesty's Navy, or the Navy of France, and you really didn't have a lot of say in it, and you were, and understandably, things probably weren't going so well for them if that's the way they were getting their recruits. But this was something that really angered the colonists, understandably. But we also have mixed things going on because, as is similar to today in politics, there were many men getting very rich off of the shipping trade, and they didn't really want to shake things up too much. And so you really have a struggle, troubles that really culminated in the War of 1812, which we'll see when we talk about James Madison. But it really starts here with John Adams. So that's kind of where John Adams gets to step into. And it's a tough place for someone to step into and to draw lines of who do you stand with, who do you stand against, where do you draw the line. And America was a very small country. We didn't even really have a navy. And that's one of the first steps he takes, is to commission the building of some navy vessels, because we can have all these shipping vessels, but they can just stop your shipping vessel and take some guys off it, and there's really nothing you can do. And you know, speaking of presidents, it's the idea of walk softly and carry a big stick. Well, America didn't have a big stick at all. And so that's where they kind of had to come up with a navy and start to really take some ownership of the high seas, as it were. Otherwise, people could just run roughshod over your shipping and over your laws in that situation.
Yeah, so Adams, he served only one term,
mm-hmm.
and he ran for another term, but was not elected. And a lot of his policies were controversial,
yes.
Both in his party and, of course, with others. It's it's amazing to think about the amount of contention between men like Adams and Jefferson, and these men were on the opposite of a lot of different issues. You talk about how they worked together for the Declaration of Independence, and it's a reminder of how people that think very differently can work together. But there was a lot of disagreement, a lot of contention, and some of his policies, some of his acts, the things he did were quite unpopular.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to get into a little bit of detail on some of those acts, it's interesting because while we have the French Revolution has happened, the French Revolution was very different from the American Revolution, mainly in large part to the people that were involved, as well as the systems that were put in place afterwards, where France very much falls back into just having another strongman, mm-hmm. Napoleon Bonaparte, taking over, and where there's much corruption. Also, there is the culture and the people of France were much less inclined to self-government, mm-hmm. Than the people of the 13 colonies of the United States. And so we have rabble-rousers and people that were very much, we would maybe call them almost of a anarchist type wing, mm-hmm. immigrating to America, to the United States. France was very much in turmoil for quite a bit of time, and a lot of people who, you know, maybe didn't necessarily agree with everyone or had troubles because, you know, originally they were using the guillotine on the nobles and trying to clean things up. But it wound up being very much kind of a bloodbath, mm-hmm. where anyone who wasn't saying the right things or doing the right things, their life was in jeopardy. And so, of course, those people wind up immigrating, and some of them do wind up in the United States. And this is very troubling to Congress, to the government, because having people stirring up with seditious ideas, people stirring up ideas of anarchy, of throwing off this brand new government that we just formed over here, is a really bad idea. Mm. And so what happens is Adams and Congress, they pass a few laws, and one is called the Alien Law, under which the president was authorized to send anyone whom he might judge to be dangerous out of the country. They also pass a Sedition Law, which was passed under which a man might be put in prison for publishing anything false or malicious against the government. Turns out, when we see what actually came of these things, the president did not send anyone out of the country nor imprison anybody. But this precedent, what was set forth, really angered the Democrat side, the wing of the Democrat Party. And Adams, as we said before, was a Federalist. And this really gives, and understandably why he is a one-term president, mm-hmm. really gives them a stick to beat him with, as we kind of say in politics, where you've handed the other side something that they were able to spin, like we're saying here, nothing actually came of it. It wasn't actually used. It was just put in place.
Right.
But the fact that he went along with it and that it was something that happened under his leadership was something that they were able to use against him in a very effective way.
Yeah, and they painted him as despotic, that this was a complete
grasping
breach.
For power.
Right, power and a breach of liberty, and understandably so, mm-hmm. as we think through. As you said, none of these things were used, but and from a Federalist perspective, it makes sense because he's trying to maintain this fragile yet government, and yet you find here, as you think through the laws of unintended consequences, that putting these sorts of precedents would be, no doubt, at the very least, extremely unpopular with a fledgling nation that has just come out of a measure of despotism of its own, and the questions and the debates about how far do you go to protect the government,
Right.
And to protect its capacity to function from seditious speech and the like.
Right. Well, and that's something we will see moving forward. Many presidents have had that come into play in their presidency. How far do you go to protect the union?
Right.
How far do you go to protect the government? And while, and also there's many times where there's not really a precedent for what they're doing, but what are they to do?
Right.
In these situations, and they are there as a part of the executive branch to really take and to preserve this country to the next person to hand it off, hopefully very similar to how they found it, to that next president, which, like I said last time, is a very unique thing in history at this time and still today, that it is a bloodless, there's no loss of life, that a president, whether you like it or not, and I'm sure we've watched inaugurations that we've been positive about and ones that we haven't been, but even to this day, there is a peaceful transfer of power, which is an amazing thing when you think about it throughout history.
And it is worth, in Adams' defense, it's worth mentioning as well that of the acts he signed, I believe he signed five of them, three of them did sunset very soon afterwards. So it was an extremely temporary thing, and they had made provision within these laws for them to sunset within the matter of years.
Yes.
And so it was certainly not something where he was attempting to put on the books a long-term plan. It was more a short-term proviso in order to strengthen our borders, mm-hmm. Protect citizenship, and to bring about through them a nature of temporary insulation against the seditious mindset that was really pervasive in France at the time, and would be for a while yet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, and these were very interesting times. Mm-hmm. One thing that does come up, and this is something that because of these acts that Adams puts forward, and like you said, they did sunset and were not really used. Mm-hmm. This starts something that I think it's good to bring up, that it begins a pattern. And this is something that will bear more fruit down the road. But we see, we see that this idea didn't sit very well with the Democrat side, these overreaching bills and these laws. And we see that. So, a John Taylor, who was a member of Congress from Virginia, he vehemently opposed President Adams and had so much disgust for these bills that were put forward that he put out there that Virginia was not bound to respect them. Mm. This is interesting because it's really beginning to test the states.
Yep.
In this union, is this thing really going to stick? And as we know throughout history, this is just the start, and it really does kind of come to a fullness in the Civil War, but that's getting way far ahead of ourselves. But it's interesting to know, where do things start? Because
right.
You don't just wake up one morning and have a Civil War. You have, it takes many, many years and a pattern of this. So just to go into a little bit of detail, So he's saying Virginia doesn't really have to abide by this, and he was claiming these laws were unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And Jefferson and Madison sympathized with John Taylor, which is interesting, and as did Mr. Nicholas of Kentucky, another congressman. And together they planted a new thistle seed. This is interesting. Resolutions were written by Jefferson declaring the national constitution to be not a form of government adopted by the people, which it does say we the people, but you know that's but only a compact between the different states, and that the parties making the agreements were not the people but the states as political corporations. So it was vesting more power within the states.
Right.
So it begins this thought process. And so Mr. Nichols of Kentucky, the congressman, managed to have the legislature of Kentucky pass the resolution. James Madison changed them a little, and they were passed by the Virginia legislature. John Taylor even tries to have Virginia and North Carolina set up a confederacy. Have we ever heard this before? And we did have a confederacy before the Constitution, which is interesting. So they're kind of meddling with things. But turns out the people were satisfied with the Constitution. So there is that check and balance, even within the state government. It really does come to the people making this call. And so they were satisfied with them. And so nothing really ever comes of that. It was kind of some interesting moving around. What does happen, and what we see here, and we will see moving through various presidents, is this idea that when anything happens that we're not really thrilled with, we're going to threaten to secede.
That's right.
And so whether that was and we'll get into detail later on about whether they could or couldn't and how that all works out. But it's interesting that this idea starts very, very early. The idea that, okay, as long as the game that is being played and as long as the systems are working for my state and we're happy, we'll stick around.
Yep.
But as soon as things aren't the way we really like it, or our party doesn't get what we want or whatever, we're going to start threatening to secede. And that sadly, and we've seen it today, where things like impeachment and other things begin to almost be used flippantly,
yeah,
wherever we have issues, mm-hmm, with what's going on in government. And this is really what happens with the secession idea until, like we said, in the Civil War, this actually does really happen. Mm-hmm. And so, interesting to note, interesting, something to tuck away in our memory. And as we continue on, we'll see this pop up again and again until 1860. But definitely something that didn't just happen then. It wasn't just during that time of a civil war. It was something that started and harmless enough and started by some of the founders, like Thomas Jefferson,
mm-hmm,
who, yes, he and Adams were at odds much of their life,
yeah,
especially after the Declaration of Independence and those kind of things. They were kind of friends before that. But they do die very much appreciating each other, and they die on the same day, which I think we'll get into more when we talk about Jefferson, but it's kind of an interesting part of American history. And that day was 4th of July.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so I mean, a lot more could be said about that, but I think that will wrap it up for today. With John Adams. So next week we will get into President number 3, Thomas Jefferson. And as always, hope that you were helped, edified,
yeah,
that there was some learning that took place today. Any thoughts, any questions? WCRP, that's Wright County Restoration Project, WCRP@LegacyBaptistChurch.net. Send your thoughts, send your questions. Like, share, subscribe, do all of those good things. If you enjoyed this, tell people that you know. If it's helped you, maybe it'll help them as well. And hopefully we can start getting people to the point where you understand more about your presidents, understand more about some of these decisions that led to bigger things down the road. We talk about the law of unintended consequences and how these debates have always been going on.
Yes.
They went on. They kind of, at least the states' rights debate, crescendoed in 1860. To 1865, and yet we're still having it today.
Very
and that's
much.
Not that's not something that is to be underappreciated.
Yes.
That these debates are still going on and most likely will as long as we have a republic. So that is it for this time and for our 13th episode, and we'll see you next time on the Wright County Restoration Project podcast.